You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
Our last program in May for 2025. We're recording this on May 28th. We'll broadcast on May 29th. And the weather today is gorgeous. Sunny and clear, going up to a high of 87 degrees with a low tonight of 52. We've got a major heat spike happening for 2 days, and we're going to drop right back down. A little confusing living here in the valley sometimes. So the temperature on Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be 93 degrees. Thursday night will be 61. Many people here will find that uncomfortable. I can hear you laughing in other parts of the country. Friday's high temperature will be 103 degrees, according to the National Weather Service. We've been watching this go up and down. Friday and Saturday are going to be hot. A high pressure ridge is going to build over us very briefly, just for 2 days. It's going to get still. It's going to be hot. And they were first saying 105, then it was going to be hotter on Saturday, then on Friday, and so forth. The current iteration from the National Weather Service is that Friday will be 103 degrees. Friday night will be 64 degrees. Many people will find that uncomfortable. Saturday will be 101 degrees. Saturday night will be 60 degrees. And then Sunday, 90. Sunday night, 56. Monday, 84. Monday night, 54. And Tuesday, 81. So back to slightly below average temperatures for this time of year in the Sacramento Valley. But lots of people getting concerned about those temperatures. Is it too late to plant? How do I water? Et cetera, et cetera. Check daily, water as needed. And one version of that that I do want to throw on when we're going into a 2 or 3 day heat spike like this, a short-term heat wave, that check daily would be best done in the morning. Just because if you go out there in the morning and the plant's drooping and you don't water it, come back at the end of the day and it's 103 degrees. It may not be dead, but it'll definitely be stressed. So I do like
now, before you go on, I want to remind listeners that when it gets really, really hot, sometimes your plants will droop when they don't need water.
Right.
It's just a reaction to being really, really hot.
But most things that we're talking about have just been put in recently. So I would be concerned about a newly planted within the last, say, 2 to 3 weeks, tomato, pepper, squash, melon, impatiens, any of those types of things. They'll show you if they need water. They will droop. To Lois's point, if you have a squash plant and it's the middle of the day and you're out there and the leaves are drooped, that's normal for zucchini to do that in the middle of a hot day, no matter what. Check the soil before you water. But first thing in the morning, it should have adequate turgor. If you go first thing in the morning, you'll get a more accurate presentation of the soil's moisture needs than if you go out at 2 in the afternoon. More to the point, if you're about to head off to work, a little hand watering right before a hot day, at the beginning of a hot day, would probably be good precaution. And as I say, check daily water as needed. Things that I put in 2 weeks ago are not needing daily watering. And I'm talking about tomato plants. You know, 2 weeks ago, from 2 weeks ago, they're now 2 feet, 3 feet tall. They've rooted down into the zone being irrigated by the drip system. I don't even really need to continue hand watering those. But the ones I put in 3 days ago, you bet I'm going to check them each morning and again at the end of each day. But at least check daily water as needed.
Now, for the rest of your yard that's not little baby plants, would you recommend running one more cycle of watering before the heat wave comes?
Indeed.
Just to give them a little buffer?
Yes, if you're listening to the show on Thursday, be a good time to give everything a really thorough, deep soaking. We really like for you with the shrubs and trees in your yard to give them a real long soaking every now and then. Every 2 weeks for a tree that is a relatively moderately high water user, birch trees, things like that. Every 4 weeks for established trees that are lower water users, but a really thorough soak. I mean, a low drip system going for several hours, for example, or a soaker hose run overnight if it's a fairly low output, or even just a hose set at a trickle here and there around the drip line of a tree. This would be a good time to do that because the ET rate over the next few days is going to be very high. It's going to be our first triple digit temperatures of the year, I believe. And a plant getting stressed early on like that can lead to a lot of leaf burn, and can the main thing that happens is on a lot of deciduous species, the new growth stops. They're flushing out lots of great new growth. The growing point is one of the first things to go if a plant is drought stressed. So a good deep soaking now can make a big difference in continuing the growth on those ornamental trees, the shrubs, things like that. And it can be as simple as Lois says, just run the system one more time. You know how to turn it on manually at your timer. If this is the simplest thing for you to do, it's going through its normal cycle, assuming that's accurate and correct. You're correctly irrigating. Just going out manually running it through another cycle can be sufficient if it's correctly set in the first place. Hand watering bigger trees, this would be a good time to start that anyway. So maybe now is the time to do it. And for your vegetable garden, we're already seeing many samples coming in, people who've been planting vegetables since mid to late April all the way through May, and the plants are stressing, or the new growth has ceased, or the leaves are looking unhappy. And when we talk about the watering, they're using drip systems, which is great for their efficiency, but they're not running them anywhere near long enough. This would be a good time to bring your soil to field capacity. Okay. That means saturate it really thoroughly and let it drain out. And now you're starting with soil that has the absolute maximum water available to those plants. You should be able to go at least a couple to a few days before you need to water again. But if you're in a raised planter, you may need to water again pretty quickly. If you're out in the garden, you should be able to go a few days. But if you give it really thorough soaking to everything, including the nearby shrubs and trees and the grasses nearby, that'll be good, not just for the plants, but for those beneficial insects and the birds and all that wildlife you like to encourage in your yard. Speaking of which, before the show, I had to go out and chase 30 turkeys out of my backyard. So it's not always wildlife. You know what they're coming in for? The water. So I just chased them out, and they can go out and find water elsewhere on the farm. I'm sure we'll talk about wildlife later on in the program. Wildlife like gophers and squirrels and things like that. Okay, we got some of those public service announcements to tell you about great programming here and things that KDRT is doing. Lois.
Well, first, I want to tell you that there's an event coming up. KDRT is co-presenting at Blue Note Brewing, which is at 750 Dead Cat Alley in Woodland. But on Sunday, June 1st, from noon to 6, there's going to be a program with Vinyl Bazaar and the live music of the Bottom Dwellers. So if you want more information about that, you can go to BlueNoteBrewingCompany.com, and there'll be a schedule and all that other stuff.
Okay.
What else we got? Oh, Don, did you know that they took all our programs, threw them in the air, and landed? We have a new schedule?
We do.
It's not quite that random, but there's a lot of stuff that's changed on that schedule. So listeners, go to kdrt.org, click on the schedule tab, and find out where your favorite shows have moved to, if they've moved, or, like our show, have stayed exactly where they've been, Thursday at noon and Saturday at 9 a.m.
Yes, we've been Thursday at noon since 2005, so it hasn't changed in all that time. There are some cool new shows on here. There was one that caught our eye. What is it? 10 Years Forgotten. You know, I like to mention the new programming because keep in mind, there's 30, almost 40. I think there's 40. Locally
42.
Produced, 42 locally produced shows, folks like Lois and I and others who are every week putting together great music, great public affairs shows. 10 Years Forgotten, this is a great topic. Your host, John Emery, focuses on modern classics and indie standards from 2000 to 2010, the decade, as they say here, lost to the decline of the record store industry. 10 Years Forgotten also explores the history of record stores in the Sacramento Valley, including why some are still open today, along with the future of physical and digital music locally, regionally, and beyond. That's a new show here at KDRT, 10 Years Forgotten. The first shows of this millennium? Sure, why not? the first music of this millennium, and that is presently scheduled Wednesdays, 3 to 5 p.m. A lot of the music shows rebroadcast at various times during the week. That's what tends to get moved around. So if you have a favorite rebroadcast time, just click on the schedule guide and you'll see where it's moved to.
And this new show is with John Emery, E-M-E-R-Y. And I thought, that face looks familiar, but what? And I looked him up on his bio here. It turns out he is the same person who is producing that California Sound, which is Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m.
Yeah, so like us, he's putting out two programs every week, and that's all for your enjoyment here at KDRT. If you like KDRT, if you like what you hear, if you like the diversity of programming here, just go to the support button while you're over there looking at the schedule guide and send some money. That's what keeps us on the air. Okay, lots of topics today.
Oh, Don, I had up in front of me that post. It's a Facebook post from the city of Davis. Oh, there. Okay, I got it back. Mm-hmm. This is a picture of the corner of Washoe and Cowell in Davis. So that people. And one of our listeners, Gaina, is a resident in that area and sent this in. Tell us what I'm looking at, Don. It was an empty lot. And it's
it was an open space site. Yeah, and the city of Davis posted this on Facebook to just call attention to something that volunteers are doing here. Corner of Washoe and Cowell, as noted, the site was reclaimed, as they say, from a mix of non-native flowers and grasses with help from volunteers and neighbors and the city's open space staff. So this is a cooperative effort. There's several of these going on around Davis. This is one of the things I think is really cool about this town, is that when people do something like this, they contact the city. The city doesn't come in and mow what they're doing and say, don't do it. The city says, sure, we'll help with this. So since 2017, this group has worked to remove the grasses and steward, as they say, a mix of native plants and some small flowering shrubs to support pollinator diversity in the urban environment. And the flowers are in bloom. There's golden lupin, which is the official city of Davis flower, blooming there. I'll come back to that in a moment. And Gaina is the driving force behind this corner. And I happen to know that I've known Gaina for a long time, taking plants down there, putting them in, carrying down gallon jugs of water and hand watering them until established. This is something, it's so simple. I mean, I say it's simple, it's time consuming, but it's so simple that one person can actually get a young oak tree or a ceanothus or something established, just watering them correctly through their first year, asking native plant experts how to water, you know, things that are native, perhaps here, perhaps nearby here. We don't have a lot of, say, ceanothus native here, but there are some species, and people often bring in native plants from nearby plant communities. And you just have to hand water them because there's no irrigation to this corner until they're established. And then generally they're choosing things that can be either live on the natural rainfall cycle, like poppies and lupins, or can be on their own once established after 2 to 3 years in the ground with just hand watering for those first couple of years. Corner of Washoe and Cowell, I do want to mention the golden lupin. Lupinus densiflorus aureus is blooming, finishing up its bloom now around town. This is a yellow, golden yellow version of lupin, which is native, literally native here, and many years ago was proclaimed to be the official City of Davis flower. So people come in and say, do you sell seeds for this plant? And we say, no, we have no source of seeds for this plant. I have even tried to buy them online. We tried to buy some so we could sell this plant, and we started them and they came up. The seedlings of Lupinus densiflorus are very recognizable. And when we bought seeds, we got the wrong lupin. And that happens when you buy seeds from online purveyors. So we don't have a source of the seeds. We can't sell them. At various times over the years, they have sold them at the Arboretum, I know, in little packets. More to the point, if you happen to see some growing in a public area, and you happen to notice that they're setting their pods right now, those pods will be ripening, getting ready to split and mature and scatter their seeds. I don't think anyone would object if you took a couple of pods for your own use for next year. You might want to find out if, you know, you're in the Arboretum. I'm not giving you permission to do this. If you're on Pub City land, I'm not giving you permission to do this. I'm just saying it could happen. And that would be one way to get a hold of the seed. Then you get to do some research and find out what exactly is involved in germinating lupin seeds, because they do have some specific requirements. So it can be a fun project for people to learn a little bit about plant propagation and growing things from seed. But no, you're not going to go into any nursery in our area and find golden lupin on the seed rack, because it's not something that's in the seed trade. However, backing up, open space site, this is wonderful. There are various of these around town where you'll see people coming together, planting things, pulling the weeds. This is the important part, managing the weeds, working with the city to manage the weeds in some cases, hand irrigating, choosing plants that can tolerate that, being patient and learning from our mistakes, I guess, would be the one thing I would throw in there. So great, great little article that the Davis City put on Facebook. And it's wonderful to see these kinds of things happening on just open corners, green belts, vacant lots, not privately owned vacant lots, but city lots and so forth. Great, great article. Congratulations, Gaina, for this publicity.
So, Don, do you happen to know that whether someone planned this, because it seems to me that you would want to group your plants so they need the same kind of watering or whatever. Did someone plan this? Was there a professional? Was it done by people or was it random?
Dana, would you answer that question? Send us a note at davisgardenshow@gmail.com. I don't know whether Gaina just started planting things there and, you know, wanted to see what would happen if an oak tree was growing, or whether they went to the city staff and said, I'm planning to do this. Most people just start doing this kind of thing. Yeah. And then the city staff has to decide whether they're going to cooperate. Working with Tree Davis, I'm involved, obviously. The city staff has been phenomenal. I mean, they will come in, they will take out trees, they will bring in wood chips, they'll do all kinds of things. They'll dump a giant pile of wood chips next to a project that we're working on for us and volunteers to spread around. That can be a really simple way to manage weeds. And I will say, the main issue in any of these kinds of projects is going to be how you manage the weeds that'll come up with the first rains and what you're going to do about that. Hand pull them, mulch them, and so forth. So there's a lot of hand weeding, there's a lot of hand watering, and pretty soon you have this amazing pollinator friendly. I'm going to go beyond pollinator friendly. I know we're all fixated on pollinators. I'm going to say wildlife friendly, because birds aren't pollinators. And, you know, skunks aren't pollinators, but they
might. You might get an alligator lizard in there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's lots of great wildlife that we would be encouraging. So it's a wildlife-friendly habitat, let's put it that way.
People-friendly, too.
That too.
It's wonderful to look at that stuff, and there's always something blooming. It's just amazing. Well, we have a message here from Tara in Oakland. Hey, didn't you say that you met her?
Yes, Tara stopped by the nursery. Always great to visit with you folks.
Cool. Okay. So it says, good morning. On this week's show, y'all briefly mentioned gophers and roses, which was a teaser for me. Would you please do a deep dive into gopher management in the garden? How does Don keep all his plants in the ground alive with gophers? Yeah. Specific guidance on gopher cage dimensions for various plants would be appreciated. I haven't had much success with trapping.
Yeah, trapping is challenging. So you can go look into the Maccabee gopher traps and you can kill a gopher. But gophers are territorial. However, they also reoccupy runs as much as 10 or 20 years later. So if you know you kill the one, another one is sure to move in there. They are my major, major pest problem on my farm. Gophers are my number one enemy. I've many times told the story of the 30 peppers in 30 days phenomenon, where I did a whole new vegetable garden, did a drip line path. It was the most orderly vegetable garden I had ever constructed. I put in my peppers and my tomatoes and whatnot, and I went out each day. I'd come home and another pepper was gone. They just worked their way down, 30 peppers. That's all I had, 30 days, peppers completely gone. So part of it was that I had loosened the soil in this area and brought in a drip line. I might as well have put up freeway markers that said, hey, gophers, over here, here are the really cool stuff. Follow the moist soil. It's right over here, because everything around that drip line was dry. So that's part of it, is you can actually inadvertently encourage them. They are lazy animals and they like to go through already loosened soil to the greatest extent possible. So I have adopted two things. First one, I've mentioned this before, and this is just anecdotal. I'm not claiming there's scientific research here, but I was very frustrated. This was easily 20 plus years ago. And at a Rodale Press publication, they were the publishers of Organic Gardening magazine, but they had also all these books and publications on pest control. There's this casual comment, gophers don't like members of the mint family. And I thought, well, that seems oddly specific, but sure, why not? I've got 30 holes. Okay, there's nothing in them. So I started filling them with lavender plants and they left them alone completely.
Lavender is a mint
thing. Yeah, lavender is in the mint family. Most of your favorite cooking herbs are in the mint family, as well as many ornamentals such as lavender. So I went ahead and planted them. They left them alone. They were still going through that area, no question. They were moving right on into my backyard and taking out plants in there. And I'd see the clean out mounds and so forth. So they left the lavender alone. I thought, well, this is all right. I did Tucrium, which is germander, mint family, left it alone. I did Nepeta, you know, catnip, but I was talking about catmint, the ground cover relative of catnip. They left that alone. I put in some native salvias, our California native salvias, which get big. They left them alone. I put in rosemary, and they haven't touched that. 20 years later, I still have lavender in there. I put in oregano. It's reseeded like crazy. I have a 20-foot bed of rosemary. They may be feeding on the roots for all I know, but it's certainly not hurting the plants. So this particular observation from Rodale Institute appears to be valid, that they, at least on my property, under my conditions, anecdotally, are not eating members of the mint family. Your mileage may vary. However, that didn't give me any vegetables. So that was a frustration. So what I did next was I dug deep down our soil. You can do this 18 inches down in a bed that looked about like you might want to drop a coffin into it. And I took this wire product called hardware cloth, which makes no sense, but it's a heavy gauge poultry wire that you can buy at local feed stores. And it comes
How big are the holes?
The holes are a half inch at most. Okay. There's nothing a gopher could get through. And it's pretty heavy duty. It's heavier duty than typical chicken wire, but it's malleable. Two people can easily shape it to the shape of the bed. And I did that. I've done that on three or four places around the property where I had a vegetable garden. I want to grow root vegetables. Well, you're definitely not going to grow root vegetables if you have gophers. So we lined one bed with this material, hardware cloth, heavy gauge poultry wire, basically, but a pretty fine, you know, as I say, half inch maximum hole. And they left, you know, they didn't get in there. Obviously, they could, if they wanted to, spend some time chewing through. They have very strong teeth. But again, they want to move reasonably quickly and they would just go on by. So that was one thing that worked, was lining beds and then backfilling them with the native soil, which I took the effort to go ahead and amend at that point, since I was, you know, digging it out anyway. And I very successfully grew root vegetables in those beds for quite a while. One thing I did realize quickly was that this could become a nightmare if you're rototilling. So I very carefully put in permanent stakes on the corners and edges of these underground wire beds. Going along with a rototiller, hitting that wire stuff underground would be no fun. So be sure to mark the areas. But that worked very well, lining the bed with this type of material. It's the same thing gopher cages are made from. My biggest problem with gophers in recent years has been where I planted roses, because they love young, newly planted roses. If you plant a rose in an area where gophers are active, it'll be gone. They will eat all the way up to the stem. And that happened a couple times. So I began to realize that I had to put them in some kind of protective cage. For roses, I use the kind that are designed for a 5-gallon or a 10-gallon container. You can buy these. You can buy gopher cages made out of the same material I've been talking about. You could make your own by just taking that heavy duty hardware cloth and wrapping it around a 10-gallon container. That's the size you need. No need to put in the ground. Dig your hole, put it in there, backfill with the soil, plant into that. First question always comes up. Don't they just eat the roots when they go through the wire? Apparently not. All I can say is when I've done this, it works. When I haven't done it, the roses get eaten. So anecdotally, once again, once the roots get out, maybe the soil has settled so they're no longer as attracted to the area because it's not still loose. Maybe they're woodier and tougher and less desirable. Whatever the case, when I do use these cages and they're only slightly bigger than the container size of what's going into them, the plants establish. They at least get the roots established in the cage. Then they appear to push out and everything is fine at that point. So they don't have to be that much bigger than what you're planting. This is the key question I get. Don't you need to use a 15-gallon size for a rose bush? No, I've used a 5-gallon or a 10-gallon size for a rose bush and gotten very good results. Also, fully established roses on my property aren't bothered by the gophers. I mean, these are big plants that are 6 feet across and clearly have roots everywhere. If the gophers are feeding on their roots, it's not doing any damage that I'm seeing. But I have had them come in to 2- and 3-year-old plants that I thought had gotten past the problem that I didn't plant in a gopher cage, and they get very active around it. And I walked out one day 2 years ago and one of my 3-year-old rose bushes had fallen over and its roots were completely gone. So will getting established, that protection seems to be very important. Once fully established, it seems that they do kind of leave them alone. But the cage doesn't have to be that much bigger than what you're planting. Barriers, as with every other difficult form of wildlife, barriers appear to be the best answer. And that's what you're doing here, is you're putting on root barriers, whether you're lining a whole bed with them or just putting it around the particular plant.
We have a question from Melissa, who is in Glendale, Zones 10A, Sunset Guide 22. Yep. Hello, Lois and Don. I adore, and am so grateful for your show. I've learned so much, and you've made me a more confident gardener. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Yes. My question is about an Arbutus unido tree that we have in a neglected corner. A large tree behind the arbutus, not in our property, was recently cut, and as a result, it now has more sunshine than before. As I was examining the arbutus, I noticed a division in the trunk, like a healed crack, pictures attached. I'm not sure if this damage is deep to the cambium, nor how this happened, because it's a protected corner. The bark is a different color there. Yep. Yep. My question is this tree okay? Is this type of damage leading to the eventual demise of the tree? So the sooner we replace it, the better. I was eyeballing a grapefruit tree that would certainly be more interesting. Many okay. Thanks and keep up the good work.
Let's start with the grapefruit. Ask locally how grapefruit tastes in your area, because the coastal zones of Southern California, grapefruit would not get the sugar content that you're after or that you're expecting. Grapefruits are best grown in really, really warm, high solar input areas. Texas, Arizona, the desert regions of Southern California. And I'm not sure Glendale really qualifies, but it might be. So ask locally. And here was the key thing I would ask is, would you be better off with an actual grapefruit like Marsh or Ruby or something like that, or with one of the grapefruit Pumelo hybrids, such as Oro Blanco or others that you can find, Cocktail, Mellow Gold, some of the others. Generally speaking, I think in most parts of California, you'll be happier with the fruit from one of the Pumelo grapefruit hybrids. And Pumelo is pronounced Pumelo or Pumelo or Pumelo, and it's spelled at least three different ways, all apparently authoritatively. But it's a grapefruit relative that is a little more difficult to eat, but in my opinion, sweeter and much less prone to the bitterness. The bitter component is in citrus is highest in grapefruits, and particularly in the Marsh grapefruit. So that would be the first thing. If you decide to go in that direction, get one that's appropriate to your region. My guess is a hybrid will be better. Second, this picture is lovely, but it's not Arbutus unido. It's Arbutus marina. Arbutus marina is a wonderful hybrid that gets about 30 by 30. And you may not have been thinking that when you put it in. It's a big tree. It can be pruned for size control, can easily be kept at 12 to 15 feet, but it will try to get substantially bigger than that. It's become incredibly popular for a bunch of reasons. One, it's an evergreen that does well in almost all parts of California, reasonably drought tolerant, sets some fruit that's pretty and happens to be edible, although not very tasty, but more to the point, only some, whereas Arbutus unido, I wouldn't put in a corner of a backyard because you'd have a carpet of fruit underneath the tree pretty much all the time. So you chose the right one, but that's actually what you have is the Arbutus called Marina. And it might get a little bigger than you're expecting there. It does look like it did get sunburned suddenly on the bark. That's not a common problem on these, but a sudden change in direct sun on the bark did some injury. And it's also healing very well. These are great pictures. There's clearly reaction wood forming. The injury was a couple of years ago from the looks of it. It's healing over, and I suspect the tree will be perfectly safe. But the question I do have is whether that's the size of tree you want in the corner, or whether you might want to go over to something that you could manage the size and also get some fruit that you could eat. So I wouldn't discourage the grapefruit Pumelo changeover decision, but I think this tree would be perfectly safe to keep. Just look up Arbutus marina, look at pictures of it online, and decide whether that's the size of tree you're really after in that spot in your yard.
Would the Pumelo be as big as the marina?
Most of them are kept at 15 feet, but people prune citrus for access to the fruit. So if you did nothing, it could get 20 feet plus, even on what they call semi-dwarfing rootstock. But almost everybody who plants grapefruit will get up on a ladder 5 or 6 years in, head it out to keep it down 10, 12 foot range, 15 foot range, so they can reach the fruit. So Well, it would, yes, get big if you let it. It's easy to keep it down. Citrus in general, size control isn't that difficult. You prune almost any time during the warm season. And at some point, you decide this is the size you want. And you just basically shorten up the tree to that size and keep it that way. It wouldn't be hard to keep it shorter. One thing I'll say on behalf of Marina, I have pictures of Marina, Arbutus Marina, in bloom every month of the year. There's little flowers on it all the time. They're not super showy, but in the midwinter, it's in the Manzanita Madrone group. It's a close relative of Madrone, little urn-shaped flowers and clusters. In the winter, there's lots of them. Midwinter here in Northern California, December, January, February, this tree is in bloom. You know what likes little urn-shaped flowers in the middle of the winter?
Hummingbirds.
They love the Arbutus, all of the different kinds, and the Manzanitas that are closely related, and the Madrone, if you happen to be lucky enough to live in Madrone country. This tree looks so much like Madrone that a lot of nurseries are putting that on as a common name. It's not really accurate, but it's closely related. Our Madrone, which is our native member of Arbutus, is really, really fussy outside of its native range. This thing grows anywhere. Okay, Arbutus Marina is just incredibly adaptable. But the fact that it blooms year-round is very attractive to hummingbirds, to me, is a big selling point for this tree. Also, mine, which I have near my rose garden, always has bird's nests in it. It seems to make perfect habitat for whatever the birds are that make 5-inch nests. All right, Lois, what would that be?
Probably jays.
Could be. Cool. Wonderful. Great thing.
Maybe
to have.
A mockingbird. I don't know.
And those are wonderful as well. Those are good to have in your garden in the summer. So you want them in there because they help, you know, manage a lot of the pests in your vegetable garden. So I just think it's a wonderful tree in many respects. And I think this tree is fine. But again, if you want to go over to a grapefruit, look at some of the hybrids.
Back to Melissa's pictures.
Yeah.
I am looking at the one where we can see the corner and the trunk of the tree. And it looks like there is maybe 2 bricks worth of dirt there. That's why I was wondering if the grapefruit would be able to grow in such a small area of dirt.
Yeah, if you give it deep waterings, I mean, it looks like, yes, this is planted in the corner of a raised bed, and there's not going to be a whole lot of input area right around the tree to water. Bear in mind, the roots go, of course, under the bricks and out into whatever the surrounding soil provides. Taking this one
out. So this brick wall in the corner is holding back the sloped soil. On the other side, there's soil.
Yes.
And so where these roots will be coming through, if they go under the brick, they'd be like 4 feet down, 5 feet down.
Could be. Yeah. They'll find the moisture. The key would be to water correctly while you're getting the tree established. Getting this thing out of here would be a bit of a challenge because it's a pretty tight corner, but it would be a perfectly good place for a grapefruit tree. Of all the citrus, that's one of the biggest. Keep that in mind. Citrus, grapefruits and pomelos have large leaves. They're a fairly open growth habit when they're young, especially, and they get big. And so if you're looking for a citrus that'll fit more tightly in a corner, calamondins and kumquats and mandarins and so forth would do well. But you don't have as much sun input in Glendale as some of those would like. My father in coastal San Diego never did well with mandarin that I gave him because it just didn't get enough heat. So it might not be your best choice. You might want to ask locally, what are the most flavorful citrus in zone 22? Because my guess is that gardeners there tend to focus more on lemons, limes, kumquats, calamondins, Rangpur lime, Thai lime, things like that, rather than the ones where you're expecting a sweeter fruit. You don't generally, zone 22 is sort of intermediate. I could be wrong. So this would be the kind of thing that I would certainly ask locally. I would stay away from conventional grapefruits if you decide to go in that direction, because naringin is the component of citrus that makes them bitter. And grapefruits have more of that than any other kind of citrus. And the reason we like grapefruits from hot climates is they have more sugar, which masks the bitterness. My grandfather, as I've mentioned many times, salted his grapefruits because that masks bitterness as well. But, you know, maybe choose something that's naturally sweeter. Pixie mandarin is a good example. Probably gets as sweet as you want and would produce practically year-round in the coastal climates and especially parts of Southern California.
So we have a question, cockroaches in the garden?
Yeah.
This is from Wen, who lives in the Pocket area of Sacramento. And they moved away from an apartment into a house. Oh, it's wonderful they get to have a garden. But they had cockroaches in the garden and in the garage. Mm-hmm. And eventually they hired a pest control company who identified the cockroaches as the Turkestan cockroach. Mm-hmm. And from what I read, Turkestan cockroaches tend to stay outside of the house. I hope that's the case.
Yes.
But it's still disturbing to see cockroaches scurrying around in the yard. For the yard, I would love to, one, mulch thickly with wood chips, at two, build a large compost pile, and three, maintain a vermicompost bin. But we found cockroaches in all three areas. So I hesitate to implement any of these things, which I would love to do. Do you have any advice on what to do in this situation? I'm out of ideas. So first, Don, what's a Turkestan cockroach?
It's a fairly new one in California, relatively speaking. Most people confuse it with the Oriental cockroach, which has been around here for a long, long time. These are black beetle-like things, and they do scurry when you see them. Most people don't realize how many cockroaches they're actually living with outside. They're out there all the time. This is the important part. They're not harmful in the garden. They really don't do any harm whatsoever. They're just present, and they kind of gross people out. And people tend to get concerned when they come in the house. These don't usually come in the house. If they're in your garage, it's probably because there's a gap down there at the bottom of the garage floor, and they've found a way to get in. There's some moisture, perhaps, that they're able to live on. And more to the point, it's very common for people to have food sources in their garage without meaning to, like that's where they store the dog food or something like that. So watch for food sources, seal any entry points if you possibly can. Your pest control, your structural pest control company, these are termite and cockroach control companies, can give you guidance on non-chemical approaches to dealing with cockroaches, barriers, for example, or chemicals such as bait traps that use boric acid. Sanitation is the big deal. They need food and they need water, and even very small amounts of food are sufficient for them. If you have any of your garbage in your garage, if you keep your trash can in or next to the garage, they may come in. None of the things you want to do in your garden are going to make things better or worse. I think that's the best answer I can give you. You already have your standing population of cockroaches. The fact that you want to do a compost pile, things like that, I don't think that's going to make any significant difference in the number of cockroaches that are out there, nor does that really matter. They aren't a problem in the garden in any particular way. I would work with your pest control company about exclusion, about using non-chemical or safer chemical approaches to them. I did go to the IPM site, our favorite site, ucanr.edu, and there's a fantastic article there about cockroaches. They decided to put under chemical control in bold print, pesticides alone will not solve a cockroach problem. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bait products are the primary pesticides used to treat cockroach infestations. They're pastes, they're gels, they're granules. You can buy some of these. You can pay a pest control company to come in, at least do them the very first time, show you how to do the baits. Baits can be quite effective for long-term control of cockroaches. Sticky traps are often used for monitoring, but the bait products are probably your best bet. And the bait stations, which come pre-filled, so you don't have to do this yourself necessarily, are things that you can put out there, at least on just inside your garage door, for example, to try to deal with them that way. There's gels, there's a whole bunch of other ways to go. So I'm going to suggest you go to ipm.ucanr.edu in the pest notes and just look at this whole article on cockroaches. And it gives you a lot of information. You'll begin to realize that it isn't just what's out in your garden that's causing the population increases. It's got to be some food source for them. And while I agree that your compost pile, your vermicomposting could be a food source, I don't think that's going to be your major issue. And I want you to realize that these are not particularly harmful in any way in the garden. So they're gross. People don't like cockroaches. You're thinking typically of the big urban ones that are, you know, living in your house. These are outdoor cockroaches. They're just part of the environment. And if they're coming into the house, that's what I would deal with, whether you use boric acid powder, bait stations, any of the low toxicity materials for managing cockroaches. They will suggest that you seal entry points. I will tell you that, you know, they can get through very small holes, but this is one of the cases where your structural pest control technician can probably point things out to you that you didn't notice, cracks or gaps that can be sealed up with something to block them. You can use foam to fill them. You can put wire mesh over things, depending on what you're dealing with, whether it's an older home or a newer home. I mean, I'm on a farm, a house that's 100 years old. There's all kinds of holes things can get in, but I have been able to find them typically and seal them over with wire mesh. In some cases, we've used the foam aerosol type products. So barriers to keeping them from coming indoors is probably what you'll want to deal with. And I don't know how to say, don't worry about it, but that's kind of what I'm saying here in terms of them being out in the garden. They're not that big a deal. They're not harmful in any particular way. So go ahead and do the things you want to do without any particular concern about that. I think your focus will be on keeping them out of your garage. That's where your structural pest control company, what we always call termite control, but they would like you to know they do more than just termites, will be of some help. If they did recommend a spray, you might want to ask about it, find out exactly what it is, and send us the information. I can tell you about the different chemicals that are used. They're generally going to be synthetic pyrethroids, which are low toxicity, but they aren't going to be they're not going to be the most effective tool here. I think the bait stations and the powders and physical barriers are probably going to be more effective in the long run. And removing food sources inside, so at least they stay outdoors and won't give you any trouble in your garage, or as much trouble as they've been giving you in your garage. But I do suggest you go to this site, IPM, our favorite site, ipm.ucanr.edu, and do a search for the cockroach article because it is quite detailed. I know people are grossed out by cockroaches, but among the things that I run into out in my garden, they'd be probably the least of my concerns. For example, we had a customer who came in and said, "What on earth came into my yard and dug all these holes, like 20 little holes all around the backyard?" I said, "I know the answer to that one, ma'am, because it happened in my backyard too."
Skunks.
Absolutely. And she said, "Oh yeah, I smell the skunk. What do I do about it?" I said, "Stay indoors."
Yeah. Close the window that night.
Close the door.
We are on a path. They migrate between Pewter Creek, which is to the south of us, and the little creek channel, which is to the north of us. And twice a year, we get skunks going by and I can smell them at night. And it's like, okay, we're going to close the door now.
They're gone by tomorrow. They're up on the list of wildlife that lives on my farm. And they came in. They're actually very cute when they have their babies with them. By the way, their babies, just so you know, aren't really as good at controlling that spray thing as the grown-ups are. So you definitely know when they're present. And they went through my backyard twice over the last 3 or 4 weeks. And I know they did because I could go out there and they're just digging in the places leaves have piled up or places that I just planted some things. The plants are just shoved off to the side. That's how I know it's skunks. If it was squirrels or something, they'd probably be eating the plants.
And they want the bugs.
Grubs and worms and whatnot. At one point, I had planted, you know how I like to start things in those peat pellets, those expanded peat pellets? They had carefully dug up 6 in a row. For some reason, I don't know why, they just found them fascinating and they were just left on the ground. So all I did, here's what you do about it. You take the plant, you put it back in the ground, you water it and hope they don't come back that next night. They typically don't come back repeatedly. So it's a one-time thing. And then a couple weeks later, it happened again. They didn't really do any damage. And yes, of course, it's pretty easy to tell when a skunk is in the area. Skunks are entirely beneficial in the garden. They eat snails. That's important. They eat garden snails. They do eat grubs, and grubs are usually not a huge issue, but some of them are. So if they're eating those, great. And the only damage they do is just digging up the plant you wanted. My father used to have a problem with them because he liked to use blood meal as a source of fertilizer. So he'd be planting his tomato plant. He'd dig the hole, put a tablespoon of blood meal down in the bottom, plant the tomato plant back over it, go out in the morning, find the tomato plant uprooted and set aside because they were attracted to the smell of the blood meal. If that's a problem, I suggest you consider cottonseed meal or some other organic source of nitrogen. But in general, skunks, way less of a problem for me than tree squirrels or rats or things like that. They pass through. What do you do about them? Give them some birth, you know, keep clear and just let them move on through.
Don't let the dogs out. Yeah. One of the things that I always thought when I saw a lawn and it had these little, you know, holes in it, I'm going, okay, so that lawn has grubs in it because that's what they're going for. I mean, the lawn next door to it, not a divot.
Right? That lawn has or had grubs in it, and they're probably doing a pretty good level of control, but then you may have to reseed your turf. So if it's that kind of, you know, if they come in and they do a bunch of damage all in one place, that's likely in our area to be raccoons. If the plants are eaten, it's likely to be squirrels or tree rats. But if it's just a bunch of funny little holes around the yard, it's almost certainly skunks.
We have questions. Oh, we have questions, Don. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. This is from Kenneth Lowe, and he's got tomato questions for us, but I want to answer the first one.
Okay.
So It says, "Hi, Lois and Don. I had some common tomato questions I haven't seen answered recently. They seem to go back and forth as whether I should or shouldn't do something."
Okay.
So, one, should I thin out suckers? The reasoning I heard was that it concentrates all the energy into the existing branches and fruit. However, don't the suckers help provide photosynthesis for the rest of the plant?
Yes, and they can
I'm
also...
gonna add, wait. I get to answer this one.
Okay.
I get to answer this one. I grew up in backwoods Michigan, up by Canada. We had a very short growing season.
Planted tomatoes on the 4th of July.
growing season. So when the tomatoes came up and they started doing their thing, you bet we were out there taking off all the suckers. Because what happens with those tomato plants is the sucker will grow another branch. Well, then it doesn't. Anyway,
it doesn't,
so we've got bigger tomatoes but fewer of them, yeah, rather than lots more growth and a few little or some littler tomatoes.
Yeah, and so in our area we have such a long growing season that those suckers will come up and flower and fruit, and you'll be picking those fruit after the first ones that form. So this is one of those we're going to go back to the what I like to describe as the Dr. Linda Chocker Scott maxim: any practice or product that is recommended to you, ask yourself, is it necessary, is it harmful? If it's neither necessary nor harmful, this is my amendment, do it if you want. The outcome of removing the suckers is going to be fewer fruit overall in our climate, but they might be bigger. They might, the ones that you believe might ripen sooner. There's reasons for doing it. If you're in an area where there's leaf blight diseases, for example, where late blight is a big problem, removing the suckers makes the plant more open, gets better airflow in there. So those are all good reasons for doing it, but it is not necessary, certainly not in an arid climate, which includes most of California, but it doesn't hurt, except that it kind of reduces yield overall, probably. Yes, they do provide photosynthesis for the rest of the plant. It's not necessary, but it's probably not harmful.
Question two, should I thin out tomatoes?
I've never done it. I can't think of any particular reason to do it here where we have a long growing season.
The only way I would throw away tomatoes is the very first ones if they're going to have blossom end rot.
Yeah. And that's, by the way, for those of you who have ever had it, it shows up on the plant long before the fruit ripens. You just have to know what you're looking for. So if you're looking at fruit that's set really early and we've been having unusually cold and hot and basically normal weather in the Sacramento Valley, as the fruit goes from breaker stage to the next stage of yellow, if you carefully turn it upward and look at the bottom, if it's going to have blossom end rot, it's probably already mottling on the bottom, and you might as well just pick that one off and fling it away. But other than that, I don't thin tomatoes, and I can't really think of any particular reason to do so unless you're a commercial grower looking for the biggest and whatever. Again, is it necessary? No. Is it harmful? No.
You could grow a tomato big enough to carve into a pumpkin.
You can if you plant the right kind and remove every other fruit. So way back when, and you can find this article on my business website, redwoodbarn.com, someone sent me a book about growing championship tomatoes and pumpkins. And so I wrote an article on that topic. And the way you do it is you plant the right variety, like one called Big Zack is a popular one. You grow the plants as vigorously as you possibly can. As soon as they set, you remove all except one. Ooh, is that a hard thing to do? And then the entire vine, this 8 to 10 foot vine, is putting all of its energy into one tomato. And if you do that, you might win a championship with a 7 or 8 pound tomato the size of a cantaloupe. The picture
I'm
of
not
that.
Sure you could eat it, though.
You can see there. It's an okay variety. I've grown it. It's a sort of a, like a giant beefsteakish thing, kind of watery, but it's fun to do. However, you're putting a lot of water and energy into one tomato, so that would be the only reason for doing it. And also, when you go into the deep dive or down the rabbit hole, as they say, of the folks who do that, some of them prune the vines, some of them don't prune the vines, some of them shade the vines, some of them don't shade the vines. These are very mostly engineering type folks who have figured out their own system. Is any of that necessary? No. Is it harmful? Probably not. But you're only growing, you know, one really big tomato. Okay, next.
Okay, the third question. I saw recently on a YouTube short of people bending the tomato plants when they're about 2 feet tall, trying to encourage root growth along the stems. If we plant the tomato plants deep, or bending the stem, or bearing it down at the time of planting, is this the same thing?
Basically, yeah. Go for it. I plant deep. That's what I do.
Yeah. Okay. Question four. Another YouTube short recommended that we top the tomato plant when it is about 4 feet tall to concentrate the growth below. That seems kind of strange. Well, you know, this is the same. This is the same thing if you were in Canada and you had 3 months of growth.
I guess. I mean,
why not just buy a determinate
variety? I think that YouTube video person needs to talk to the person who wants to thin out suckers, and they'll find they don't have any meeting of the minds there.
Can then just lay over the whole plant, bury the whole thing, and not have tomatoes.
Sure. Someone sent me a YouTube of a guy who had a secret. By the way, I usually don't watch YouTube videos, so I did watch this one, but for the most part, I don't find them very elucidating. But this particular one, here's my secret, is what it boiled down to. He spent 5 minutes showing this. When he plants it, he heads it back. Okay, fine. What that will do is delay the fruiting of your first tomatoes a little bit because you've cut the main growing point and you're waiting for new ones to form. But they will. They'll grow, they'll flower, they'll fruit. And if you have a long season, you'll get probably more fruit overall. I don't know. It just seems unnecessary, but that's fine. It's taking the principles of plant physiology and trying to turn them into some practical application. I plant tomatoes in the ground. I water them. I put a cage around them. If they poke out of the cage, I push them back in. If they're bothering me by crowding the path, I cut that branch off. More commonly, I push it back in. That's it. That's all I do. I don't thin them. I don't remove suckers. I don't top them or anything. But we do have a very long growing season here. So some of these things seem like they might have come out of special climate conditions that we don't have to worry about in California.
I wonder if maybe the roots aren't growing well.
Hard
maybe
to say.
They're trying to bonsai it or something.
Yeah, hard to say. Anything that reduces the number of flowering points reduces the number of fruit total, but there may be reasons you'll want to do that. Like you can't get all your fruit to ripen. If you're in a place where fruit's setting in September, well, to me, fruit setting in September, great. I'll be harvesting that fruit in late October. There's a lot of folks listening in places where you're not harvesting anything in late October. So we try to understand that we have a worldwide audience.
Yes. Okay. Question five. Do we need to fertilize tomato plants once they're established?
I don't, but that's my soil. Mine go in with enough nutrients around them in the form of the potting soil I put them into that feeds them everything they need. Before, I used to do this technique where I transplant into enriched potting soil where I would just put the young plants right in the ground. I would put some kind of fertilizer in at the time of planting. Be cautious about using a lot of nitrogen on tomatoes. You get more leaf and you don't get more fruit. In fact, you may get less fruit if you overdo it. And nitrogen can come from any of a number of sources, whether it's manure or a product that you bought, an actual fertilizer or fish emulsion. So in general, in our area, we tell people, fertilize the young plant at the time of planting or a couple weeks after planting, whatever, it's fine. In general, you don't need to do any more than that unless you have a raised planter and you brought in soil that doesn't hold nutrients, in which case you do need to provide a steady supply, light but steady supply of nitrogen. So raised planters are always a different answer because they're basically potting soil no matter what you filled them with. It's almost always something you bought in that drains quickly, doesn't retain nutrients, and of course doesn't retain moisture that well. So for that situation, you do need to fertilize the tomato plants once established because there just isn't enough in that soil that you brought in. So you can top dress with something that has some chicken manure in it. You can fertilize with fish emulsion. Just be gentle. Too much nitrogen is actually detrimental. And don't worry about the phosphorus or potassium content of the fertilizer. They're not, unless you've had a soil test that indicates a deficiency of phosphorus, you do not need to apply it. When people ask me, as one did yesterday, do you think bone meal does anything for my tomato plants? I answer very firmly, no. I do not think bone meal does anything for your tomato plants. They don't need phosphorus, and it's a very, very slow way of providing it. I mean, they don't need additional phosphorus, and it's a very slow way of providing it, even if you did need phosphorus. So focus on the nitrogen, keep it gentle. Time of planting is usually fine, except in raised planters where you probably need to supplement it through the growing season.
Okay, his sixth question is kind of strange. Mm-hmm. He's noticed that the tomatoes, the actual fruit, the actual tomato that has blossom end rot is one of the tastiest tomatoes after I remove the dark spots. Have you found this to be true?
I have not specifically, but now that you've raised this question, I find it intriguing. The injury from blossom end rot, which is a spoilage at the bottom of the fruit, would lead to ethylene gas being released in the fruit. Ethylene is the ripening hormone in plants. It causes both ripening and senescence, that is to say, you know, death of the portion, but the ripening is what it's used for. You know how they make tomatoes for sandwiches at Burger King? They grow them in Florida. They harvest them rock hard, solid green. They put them in the gas houses that are used for that purpose, where they use ethylene and CO2, and they do it for a certain period of time, and they ripen in a predictable pattern. They send them to the market. So the ethylene is what ripens the fruit. And that is one of the first things that occurs in a plant when there's injury of any kind is ethylene production. So I'm guessing that your damaged fruit from blossom end rot are ripening faster and more thoroughly because of the ethylene production in the fruit.
All right. And Kenneth ends, thoroughly enjoy your show. Cannot wait every Thursday to hear your new podcast. Thank you for all your help in the past. P.S. I did replace my 35-year-old lawnmower so that I could keep the grass higher.
Yes, excellent, wonderful. And that's a good time for you to mention this, because you should be mowing your lawn at 3 inches height if you possibly can, as we go into the hot weather here in the valley especially. Most turf these days is fescue. Fescue is a great grass for California. Most parts of the state, it's either a fine fescue or a wider bladed type. There's a bunch of different ones out there. And the only drawback to fescue is it has a high growing point. So if you mow it short, shorter than about 3 inches in hot weather, it thins out really badly and your lawn will look bad for the rest of the summer. So keeping it mowed higher makes a big, big difference, especially for these better fescue blends that we're using so much of in California. Thanks for the letter, Kenneth. We appreciate your comments and your compliments.
So, Don, I want to know your secrets about tomatoes.
My secrets?
Have you got secrets?
Yeah.
You know, okay. Listeners, Don has no secrets. No. He'll come on the show. He'll tell you anything. Sometimes.
Put them in full sun. There's the first secret. Plant them in full sun. Don't plant them too early. Give them plenty of room. Plant them deep. Cage them and stake them well. I learned that the hard way. Water deeply. Fertilize lightly. Choose a mix of varieties, and no pruning is needed. That's it. Those are the secrets. In other words, give the plant what it wants to grow to its maximum potential. And this is what we do here. I'm just still planting tomatoes now. There are places where, of course, your season is over by Labor Day. So you're going to do things to pump them early, and you're going to try and, you know, ripen them off fast and all that kind of stuff. So do listen to local advice wherever you're listening. Talk to the people who get good yields and what varieties they're using and any practices they use. If they prune them, try it yourself, but do a little bit at least of a controlled experiment. Plant two of the same variety and prune one and not the other one. See how it goes. But the main thing is I don't crowd them. I have lots of room. I don't crowd the plants. I give them deep watering and I get them up off the ground. That's really important because, well, they will grow just fine on the ground. They'll fruit just fine on the ground.
Everything they'll be eaten just fine on the ground.
Yeah, everything that likes to eat tomatoes will come along and find them much easier to get at than if you have them up in a cage. So.
And as we always do these days, I'm going to close with a quote. And this is from Barbara Damrosch. I don't know who that is, but she's got good ideas.
Okay.
Good gardening is very simple, really. You just have to learn to think like a plant.
Okay. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.